Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
It is indeed. And Ellen, you are here, not on the other end of a Skype call. So tell us more about the ozone layer.
Well, again, first, thank you to MOTAT, as always, because they sponsor us, so they keep us coming over the airwaves. And so today, first day back in the studio, we're going to talk about the ozone layer, and we're going to go back 359 million years.
All right, let's do it.
And all was good with the world 359 million years ago.
Okay.
Okay, because it was the end of a thing called the Devonian period. I don't know
of
all
course.
This sort of stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And, you know, fish apparently were starting to come out of the seas and, you know, sort of, you know, start converting into land animals and stuff like that. Remember, we all came from the sea. And we had sort of fern-like plant species sort of all over the world and stuff like that that was starting to advance on land. And then, whammy, we had a mass extinction.
We did.
And there have been, well, it depends how you count them, but there have been five big mass extinctions on planet Earth, okay? And the last one was the big old meteor in, where was it? Mexico, that killed off all the dinosaurs, okay? So that was one of them. And up until now, it's been thought that the way that you get rid of all life on Earth is either, number one, an asteroid strike, or number two, volcanism, so massive volcanic activity.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's been sort of the currently accepted scheme of things up until now. And so there's some workers in the UK who've just published a paper looking at this mass extinction 359 million years ago. And what they did was they were getting samples of mudstone from eastern Greenland. And so they got this big 6 meter slice of mudstone, and they're busy analyzing this, and these sort of fern-like plants and stuff like that, they're all trapped in this.
Wow.
And they found a distinct cutoff whereby the spores of these plants all of a sudden started going really weird at around about this 359 million years ago. And what they're thinking is that, well, just looking at them, what they reckon has happened is that they look like they have been subjected to UVB radiation, ultraviolet B.
Light.
Okay. Yeah. The bad UV. Uh-huh. Okay. We've got UVA and we've got UVB. So UVA is sort of the longer wavelength ultraviolet light. It's not quite so nasty for you. And the UVB is the shorter wavelength ultraviolet light. And that's really nasty. Okay.
Okay.
And so they reckon that these things look like they've been irradiated by UVB radiation. And so what the climate record showed at this time was that there was a big warming of the Earth at that stage. And so their hypothesis now has become that this warming led to the destruction of the ozone layer, which let in the ultraviolet B light, and then that basically killed lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, you know, that sounds entirely plausible. The ozone layer it's a delicate thing. So if you took all of the ozone in the atmosphere, this always amazes me, okay? So we think of the ozone layer in the atmosphere as being this big protective shield, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, big, because the atmosphere is kind of big.
Yeah.
If you take all of the ozone in the atmosphere and spread it equally around the world at a pressure of atmospheric pressure, like the pressure that we are under like now, and at a temperature of 0 degrees Celsius, how thick would the ozone layer be? There you go. Here's a question for you.
Felix, you got it.
It's been a while since I've done this kind of physics.
But this always astonishes me. Go for it. Have a stab.
Many numbers.
That's a good answer.
Lots,
yes. A little bit more quantitative would be good, but 3 millimetres.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Yeah. Not a lot when you convert it to atmospheric pressure and 0 degrees Celsius. 3 millimetres.
Is how?
That's how thick your ozone layer is.
Are you serious?
No, I'm absolutely serious, okay? So we've got a lot of ozone in the atmosphere, we certainly do, but and, you know, there's a lot sort of by volume, but when it translates to this, you know, thin shield around Earth, it's 3 millimetres thick.
Stretch very thin.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it doesn't. Okay. It's not going to take a hell of a lot to really do something to that. And so basically what they're saying is that the warmer temperatures meant that you had more big storms.
Mm-hmm.
And these big storms put more moisture into the atmosphere and that put more salts and stuff into the atmosphere. And so what they're thinking is that the moisture and the salts combined in the atmosphere can catalyze the destruction of ozone. So ozone is a very, very reactive molecule in its own right, okay? So it needs to be sort of continually replenished because it's protecting us from those UV rays from the sun.
Yeah.
And when it does that, it gets destroyed. So, it keeps on being regenerated and stuff. But, you know, it's a precious bloody resource and we really are protected by this tiny, tiny, tiny layer of, you know, this amazing stuff. And so they are proposing that this is another way by which mass extinctions may occur. And they're also proposing that when you do get these big volcanic eruptions, that's pumping stuff up into the atmosphere that can also destroy or catalyze the destruction of the ozone layer. Okay.
So they're talking that will likely occur before, or it's more likely anyway that will occur than an asteroid or something.
Well, they're proposing that it could occur on the basis of, you know, warming of the atmosphere, which we all know is kind of
already underway.
Is kind of happening. So might be an idea to maybe, you know, let's be preventative about this possibly.
Well, that's more, I suppose, that's more research and evidence to say that we are talking about a mass, we're talking extinction, right? This is how serious climate change is.
Yeah,
it's
just
increased weather events, which will cause destruction on their own right, but
actual extinction. If the ozone layer goes, we're screwed. Basically, simple as that. So sorry to be a downer
today, Ellen. No, we like it. This is good. Shall we move on to our next one, hydroxychloroquine, which has been in the news a lot.
It has.
Why?
It has. Why? One word, Trump.
Yeah.
But, you know, to be fair to him, he wasn't the person who sort of started this all off. The person that started this all off was a French doctor by the name of Didier Raoul. And right in the early stages of the pandemic, he was doing a trial in France and looking at hydroxychloroquine as a possible treatment for COVID-19. And it being the time that it was, and God, it seems so long ago now, it's weird. But, you know, everything had to be done in a hurry, obviously, because, you know, everyone is flat out looking for a cure for this stuff or a treatment or whatever. And so he published his results of his study. Now, it turned out that the study wasn't at all well designed. It wasn't sort of up to the sort of standards that you would need for a bona fide medical study. But because it got out into the media that, you know, these were positive results seemingly, then obviously everyone sort of ran with it.
Snowballed.
Yep, snowballed, absolutely. And then, so hydroxychloroquine was, you know, the thing. And it is a drug. It's used in the treatment of lupus and diseases like that. But whether or not it was effective in treating or curing, indeed, COVID-19, was up for debate. Now, again, as I say, you know, his was sort of the study that got out there first and said, yes, this looks promising. Mm. However, there have been subsequent studies since sort of saying, no, not really. And worse still, it actually leads to an increased risk of death and heart problems for people who are actually suffering from COVID-19, okay? So because of this, a couple of weeks ago, the World Health Organization, you know, that august organization.
Yes.
Decided to quit any trials on hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID-19.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, they did.
Done. Dusted.
Yep, done and dusted. Wow. Now, that was due to this paper in The Lancet. Okay, The Lancet is, you know, one of the top medical journals. Basically saying that, you know, it does lead to an increased risk of death and, you know, this was a properly done study, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the guts of this, and this was a story on, I think, Stuff last week.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting, actually, because now New Zealand has put $2 million into grants that are supposedly looking at the use of hydroxychloroquine In the treatment of COVID-19.
Awkward.
Yeah, it is just a little bit. It's
expensive and unfortunate.
Yeah. So this is $2 million of money. Now, one of the trials, it says, so they're looking at as this molecule as a prophylactic role in the treatment for frontline health people, okay, yeah. So your nurses and doctors and stuff like that. And they say that the trial will start, quote, if the number of cases increases in New Zealand from the current levels. And now they're giving $427,000 for that. Last time I looked, we've got one active case in the country. Fingers crossed, touching wood and everything. Right. We're really not going to have, hopefully, any more in the foreseeable future.
So how would they then conduct a trial?
Exactly. Right. And there's another one. There's a randomised controlled trial of unproven treatments among people unwell enough to need admission to hospital but not unwell enough to need intensive care. So you're kind of sick enough to have to go to hospital, mm-hmm. but not sick enough for intensive care. And so this is $766,000 again on this. It just seems to me that, you know, the boat has sort of well and truly sailed, that, you know, people around the world have said, okay, this stuff really doesn't work.
It's over. Move on.
What's the point in investing $2 million, which is a fair chunk of change in the Health Research Council budget and stuff like that, and MB are putting money into this as well. And, you know, the question was asked on staff, or was implicit anyway, you know, why are we doing this now? It looks like we've pretty much, hopefully, got this thing pretty much under control. So
okay, that is fascinating. Maybe something to put to the government Ministry of Health team.
Yeah, I'm surprised there hasn't been that much sort of media interest in that story.
Well, now we are more informed on the scientific level. We can go forth and ask these questions. Yeah,
no, very interesting that.
Thank you, Alan. Let's quickly touch on this last one around cicadas or their wings.
Indeed. And I know when you say quickly, you mean
yes,
quickly.
I mean quickly.
Okay, who knew that cicadas had self-cleaning wings?
Not me.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Can't say I've thought that much about cicadas.
So the wings of a cicada, they repel water, which you'd kind of think they'd have to do because you don't want soggy wings, do you?
Yeah, you can't fly.
And that repels pollen, it repels dust, you know, and it's brilliant. It's sort of the self-cleaning thing. And not only that, it is antibacterial, antimicrobial, okay? So cicada wings are cool.
Cool.
Now, if we could possibly find out how cicada wings are made, what they're constructed of, then maybe we could start making antimicrobial surfaces in hospitals and stuff like that.
Oh,
we could replicate how cicadas do it. And so
very cool.
Somebody came along with that idea, which I think is just bloody brilliant.
It's brilliant, yep.
And they studied the wings of two types of cicadas, and what they found was that the wings were made up of a whole lot of what they call nanopillars. Okay? So just little pillars made up of molecules called fatty acids. Okay?
Yep.
And so what they reckon happens is, so these are, you know, sharp little pillars. So what they reckon is the bacteria come and go on the surface and they basically get pierced by the pillars. Okay, so the pillars sort of stab into them.
Yeah.
And the pillars themselves contain antimicrobial molecules and that gets into the bacteria and it kills the bacteria. Or basically those little spiky pillar things, they just rip the shit out of the bacterial wall and, you know, and it's gone. And basically that's it. So I think that's a fascinating study.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
how do you recreate that though? If we are to, because now I feel bad for the wings of cicadas, if we're all just going to go.
I know. No, them. But
do
you could do that in the lab. Yeah. So you now know that, okay, what we need is a whole bunch of these little pillars. And we're at the stage where we can sort of control the assembly of molecules in the lab to make these sorts of things. So, you know, here's our lead from nature. Nature, as I always say, it's had a 4 billion year head start on us, or 4.5 billion year head start. So we're just catching up.
We had a couple of texts. Someone saying, is UVB like 5G? JK, they were just joking. And then quoted...
No, I'll tell you what, it's worse than 5G.
Somebody's quoted, to be fair to Trump, which you said, and then they said, not on BFM, you don't, lol. And then also someone said, or ... a second wave predicted. I'm presuming that's around hydroxychloroquine, so maybe even if we did have a second wave, ideally we'd still be investing in things that are proven to work.
Yeah, I think they've basically shown that this one's dead on arrival, really. to mix metaphors.
So. Alrighty. Thank you, Alan. It's great to have you back in the studio. It's lovely to see you.
Good to see you.
And we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Will do. See ya.
Oh, sorry, guys. Laptops and everything.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. Whammy.